Thanks for downloading this podcast from The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and if you're ready, we'll begin. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And to begin, as you've no doubt learned, the Pentagon was rocked today by this unexpected revelation.
And as the president noted, I have today submitted my resignation as Secretary of Defense. It's been the greatest privilege of my life, the greatest privilege of my life to lead, and most important, to serve with the men and women of the Defense Department and support their families. I am immensely proud of what we've accomplished during this time.
Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel's resignation is apparently the culmination of a series of soul-searching discussions that began weeks ago, reportedly, with the president. Is the Pentagon simply moving in a different direction now than was the mission when Hagel was nominated? Or is this, in a way, a political casualty of the military rise of ISIS in Iraq? More on that in a moment. Also, we can blame it on Canada. As far as the Keystone XL pipeline is concerned, it's Canada's oil that's being extracted to go in that pipeline. We'll hear from Canada's ambassador to the U.S. He's a Keystone booster and calls himself an environmentalist at the same time. Also, it's no deal in Vienna on the Iranian nuclear program. And of course, we'll have some talk about Thanksgiving as the feast fast approacheth. But first, to the big news of the day, Chuck Hagel out. And of course, the president made a point to say that despite the shakeup, there is nothing wrong with this country's defenses.
Today, the United States of America can proudly claim the strongest military the world has ever known. That's the result of the investments made over many decades, the blood and treasure and sacrifices of generations. It's the result of the character and wisdom of those who lead them as well, including a young Army sergeant in Vietnam who rose to serve as our nation's 24th Secretary of Defense. So on behalf of the grateful nation, thank you, Chuck.
Joining us now, Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Todd, welcome.
Hi, John.
So I've been looking at reports here. How did Chuck Hagel seem to slip into the shadows over the last few weeks while some of us weren't watching?
Well, in fact, he didn't slip into the shadows. Chuck Hagel gave a lengthy interview to Charlie Rose just before the weekend, where he talked about Ukraine and ISIS and Pentagon policy and hotspots around the world. So if Chuck Hagel knew at that time he was leaving, he certainly didn't let on to the press.
Wow. So is this fall guy politics on the part of President Obama, who's received a lot of criticism about the military's response to ISIS, the situation in Afghanistan, and of course, even the military response to Ebola?
Well, the White House says no, of course. Let's give credit to the New York Times, who got the scoop on this story. And the Times reporting from the White House, from the senior administration officials who no doubt leaked this news, said that, look, Hagel was brought on to do a couple of specific things. He was brought on to manage the withdrawal from Afghanistan and to manage drawdown in Pentagon funds, budget cutting and reordering of priorities at the Pentagon. He was never brought on to manage a new war, a new confrontation, or something like Ebola. So different skill set. He was great at what he did. And now, because of the rise of ISIS and the confrontation in Iraq and Syria and in Ukraine and Ebola, we need to go in another direction. And Hagel agrees with that. That's the White House line.
And that's completely absurd. I mean, that's like saying Ban Ki-moon is getting fired because he was brought on to deal with Liechtenstein. And suddenly there's a whole bunch of other things to deal with.
There's a certain amount of Washington courtesy that is standard to the culture. Yeah. Yeah.
So what are Republican senators saying about this? Because now we've got a whole other confirmation hearing to go through here with a different Congress completely.
So it's fascinating. Just a couple of minutes after the news broke, Senator John McCain, who's the incoming chairman of the Armed Services Committee, went on AM radio back home in Phoenix in Arizona, where he's from. Of course, he was asked about this off the top, and McCain said that the idea that Chuck Hagel wasn't up to the job is nonsense. Chuck Hagel was completely up to the job. The White House never let him in that inner circle that manages things. Now, you have to take that statement with another piece of knowledge, which is John McCain voted against
right,
Chuck Hagel
back
at his conference. In February of 2013, I looked it up. He did vote against him, but said Hagel was completely up to the job. Oh. And he said that Hagel was in, he said, quote, in my office last week, and that Hagel himself was very frustrated because there is no strategy for confronting Putin in Ukraine. There is no good strategy against ISIS. These were all things that John McCain was saying about Chuck Hagel, that he had essentially been sidelined by a White House that doesn't have a strategy. Now, this, to be fair, is standard McCain criticism of the White House. He's now applying it to Hagel as well.
Any shortlist emerging there in Washington?
Yes, indeed. And a couple of the names won't be a surprise. Michelle Flournoy, who has served a couple of times, was Undersecretary of Defense under President Obama, widely respected, and was really considered the second choice the first time Hagel got this job after Leon Panetta lost. So Michelle Flournoy is definitely at the top of the shortlist. Ash Carter is another name people will have heard floated for Secretary of Defense. He's a former Deputy Secretary of Defense, a real money manager, chief operating officer, has held a number of two and three positions in the Pentagon. And then Jack Reed, the senator, who with the exit of Senator Carl Levin, because he's retiring, is about to become the senior Republican on the Armed Services Committee, widely respected by both parties, probably one of the few Democrats who could probably be confirmed by a new Republican Senate and an Armed Services Committee led by John McCain. I should add another thing that McCain said, which is important, John, when he was on the radio just earlier today. McCain did say that Republicans would be using the nomination of a new Secretary of Defense to get some focus on an ISIS strategy, to demand a unified ISIS strategy in Iraq and Syria, and a Ukraine strategy from the White House.
Although there's a big risk there. I mean, if the White House positions this as a management question, that's one thing. But if it positions a nominee as the ISIS killer and the Putin stopper, if it doesn't work out, it's going to look pretty bad.
Well, that's true. I mean, Hagel's nomination has not worked out, and I guess people can draw their own conclusions whether it was his own leadership or his bosses in the White House who have bungled some of the responses to Ebola, have had a slow start with ISIS for sure, and have been on their watch while Putin has made gains in Ukraine.
Todd Zwillick, thanks so much.
You bet, John.
Chuck Hagel may know his fate, but it's a tense waiting game in Ferguson, Missouri. Still no grand jury decision on whether Officer Darren Wilson will be indicted for the shooting death of teenager Michael Brown. That's the voice of Benjamin Crump, the attorney for the family of Michael Brown. And for well over 100 days, this whole community has been in a holding pattern over the question of justice and a questionable justice system. F. Willis Johnson is pastor at Wellspring Church. Hello, Pastor.
Thank you for having me.
What is this waiting like for your parishioners, for you, for the whole community?
Well, it's quite unnerving, very frustrating and fatiguing, and yet we're challenged to remain hopeful that the best will come to pass.
And yet this grand jury verdict, indictment, whatever you want to call it, is far from definitive. It doesn't even end the story. It may begin another story. Who knows?
Yes, sir. That is true. This in and of itself, this decision, this act, or even a series of acts that follow, do not bring any sense of real closure. Each step, each action, each decision in response initiates a new one. And so I've learned in my work and in my leadership sometimes that it's okay to say, I don't know. It's okay to say that, or not to say anything, just to listen and be present. There's a story in the Bible where some friends came in a troubling time, and the best thing they did was just sit still with their friend. It wasn't until they started talking and asking questions and inquiring and investigating and trying to get a headline or trying to be important and give advice that they begin to kind of mess up the situation and take it to a place that it didn't need to go. And so that's...
Well, Pastor, you should tweet out that... you know, that passage of the Bible, it probably would be useful for all of us at this point. Pastor Johnson, you know, last week as the delay, you know, went on and on and on, I was thinking to myself, this is just ratcheting up the heat in the community. But now, with the weekend to think about it and just looking at some reports, there's also a sense maybe that things are calming down, that there's a kind of a enough already fatigue and people are waiting to see what actually happens. What's your assessment?
Well, I believe that all of what you share is true. I tend to believe, though, that it may not have been so much that there was something that was going to happen as much as we've kind of raised a bar, a series of expectations that for most of us we were hoping would not become, in a negative sense, a self-fulfilling prophecy. People rise and fall to expectations. And so I think and I hope that we have learned that maybe if we ask, expect, model what is the most respectful, the best, most appropriate ways to begin to address our issues, our concerns, manage the responsibilities that we have, that in turn that will be adhere to that will be followed, and we again can see the best come to pass.
And you really do have your work cut out for you. I mean, you've got the issue of trusting the justice system, which is an important goal here. There's the whole question of how do you characterize and frame the notion of forgiveness and, you know, the Christian principles here. And then there's the racial divisions in Ferguson that are the long story, the big story here that's going to go on really for many, many years. How does a man of the cloth deal with all that at once?
Well, we wrestle God through our questions is what Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel invited us to do and challenged us to do. And I just believe it's really as basic as this, that in our faith tradition, the God who was met and met us in disgrace still dispensed grace.
So the challenge is great, but the hope is greater.
Always.
Pastor Johnson, thanks so much. That's F. Willis Johnson, who's the pastor at Wellspring Church. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
We've heard from someone who can speak to the soul and spirit of the people of Ferguson. Now let's look at some of the practical precautions that are being taken on the streets of Ferguson and in the entire St. Louis area. Tim Lloyd joins us from St. Louis Public Radio. Tim, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Oh, thanks for having me, John.
So what's going on? Schools are closed, I believe. Some schools are closed this week. What else is going on?
Well, you mentioned the school component of this. There's one district, Jennings, which is close to where protests first erupted back in August. It has about 4,500 students. It has closed both today and tomorrow. But the larger districts in the area close to sort of the epicenter of protest back in August have yet to close. And that's the Ferguson-Florissant School District with about 11,000 students. And there's some other large districts up there as well that have not closed yet.
What are the protocols here? Can they hold back the handing up of the indictment till after Thanksgiving? Does the holiday figure into this at all? Would it be better to just postpone all of this till next week?
Well, you brought up a great question, and I think that's something that is on everyone's mind here in St. Louis. The decision could be reached at any point. We know that the grand jury is meeting again today. We don't know if a decision will come today, and then when the decision will be publicly announced. We don't know any of those things. And it's that sense of unknown that is really it has a lot of people on edge here in St. Louis and all of its suburbs.
And one of the unknowns is the grand jury process itself. I mean, it's a little like some, you know, voodoo justice, you know, parallel universe where, you know, prosecutors and grand juries have a totally different relationship than you know, defense attorneys and prosecuting attorneys in open court. Are people aware of just how preliminary anything this grand jury does is?
As far as a larger community, I mean, it has sort of taken on this feel of a trial, if you will, even though, of course, that's not the case. This is just to establish whether or not any criminal charges would be brought against Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson for fatally shooting Michael Brown back in August. But it does start to feel a little like a trial as this keeps going on and on and on.
Tim Lloyd is St. Louis Public Radio reporter watching the situation there as everyone in the St. Louis metro area watches and waits. Tim Lloyd, thanks so much.
You bet. Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
One main argument for building the Keystone XL pipeline, according to those who are hard selling the project, is that it will be a big job creator. And they say it will develop homegrown energy sources in North America to eventually end reliance on energy from Iran, from the oil and gas-rich Arab nations in the Middle East, from Nigeria and Russia. With a Republican House and Senate convening next year, it's quite possible that the defeat of the pipeline in the lame duck Senate last week will be the last stand by Democrats to hold back Keystone. It has support in both parties, but has become a symbol of the environmental movement's determination to slow the production of carbon-based fossil fuels. Much of the Keystone oil would come from central Canada's vast tar sands, and Ambassador Gary Dewar, Canada's ambassador to the United States and key salesman for Keystone, has another argument. Keystone, he says, makes environmental sense because it's less polluting than the alternatives for transporting oil that the ambassador says will be used no matter what.
We believe that energy efficiency, light vehicle emission standards, which the Prime Minister agreed to the President with on having the same standards, renewables, the development in a safe way of gas, and the new constitutional amendments in Mexico on investing in oil in Mexico, the development of oil in the Eagle Ford in the United States, and Bakken oil in North Dakota, Montana, and the oil in Canada will allow us for the first time ever within a number of years to be energy secure and independent in the North American neighborhood. It's all of us together. It's not one of us, but together we can do it.
But isn't that something of a myth in the way the oil market works, and that everything is fungible and the demand is so high in the world that it sort of doesn't matter where the oil comes from? If something happens over in Iran or even in Ukraine, and Russia, of course, is a big oil producer, it's going to have an effect on price here in North America. We're not insulated from any of that.
Well, you have been affected by OPEC for 40 years that has used oil and the collective they had to determine prices has impacted the security of oil for particularly the United States. It has been an issue since Richard Nixon has been president. In fact, that's why president after president after president here in the United States has talked about energy independence in this neighborhood. We believe that over the last number of decades, the United States has been from time to time hostage to countries that do not share their democratic values. They become hostage to a grouping of petro-dictators. And obviously, Canada is a democracy and has a trading partnership with the United States that includes about 1,200 companies that supply the oil sands in Canada, including innovations on improving water use and innovations that help us reduce energy use by energy efficiency innovations that we've had.
Well, let me just ask you one more foreign policy question on this. And that is, okay, fine. So we get this oil and we're suddenly independent and we don't have to worry about these petro-dictators, as you call them. We can just pull out of the Middle East, and chaos over in that region brings down the Saudi regime, brings down – I mean, we've already had a problem. There's already chaos in Iraq, less oil from Iran. That would be catastrophic for Europe. And
we're not suggesting for a moment that as an ally of the United States, we disengage from the Middle East. What we're suggesting is that it makes more sense to have oil from the United States for your domestic demand and oil from your neighbors that are close by and have trading relationships and have democracies as the primary source of any foreign oil. But it's not an either or.
All right, let's talk about the environment. The methods of extraction in Canada, you're completely comfortable with those as being consistent with Canada's longstanding ethos of environmental preservation and wilderness preservation?
Well, there's a number of questions in that question. Yeah. So number one, Canada, we're not standing still on the environment. We have 64% of our electricity generated by renewable energy. The way to reduce the use of fossil fuels, and including oil, is to have a reduction in demand. And the way you do that is with energy efficiency, like light vehicle emission standards that Canada and the United States both joined in on, reduces per capita demand for oil. That's the way you reduce the demand for oil in the world, and that's the way we deal with it in our neighborhood of North America. The environmental industry claimed 6 years ago that if a pipeline wasn't built, the oil would stay in the ground, and that would be good for in fact, that would solve all the problems of climate change. Well, 6 years later, are they right or are they wrong? When you look at the facts, every day they delay the pipeline, there is more crude oil going on rail to markets. It's not stopping the oil being developed in Canada. In fact, the last 3 months I looked at it, 200,000 extra barrels per day were coming from Canada, coming from the Bakken oil field, going to the United States. Unfortunately, half of that was on rail instead of more energy-efficient pipelines. Pipelines, according to your scientists in the United States, have much more greater energy efficiency and greater safety. So if the president and the environmental industry says no to the pipeline, and they've been proven wrong that it stays in the ground because of that, and it goes on rail, what is the benefit to the U.S. to having all this crude oil coming through their cities on rail?
It's going to be used no matter what, and rail is less environmentally efficient than using a pipeline.
That's your scientists. All we want United States to do is use science, not ideology.
I want to conclude this discussion on the pipeline, but before I do that, could I make an attempt to put your job in jeopardy?
Yes.
Okay, great. Here we go. Is it your understanding that President Obama has promised Prime Minister Stephen Harper that he will veto the pipeline if, as is expected, the GOP Congress puts it on his desk, or he won't veto the Keystone Pipeline if the GOP Congress puts it on his desk, as is expected?
Well, he was a little more nuanced than that. So you asked me a yes or no question, and it's the president has said that he wanted the process to continue. And he certainly felt part of that process was the decision in Nebraska to challenge the authority of the governor to ultimately approve and permit that section of the pipeline.
I know all that. What did he whisper in Stephen Harper's ear?
If it was a yes or no in whispering in the ear, I would have confirmed that.
Confirmed?
There wasn't that discussion.
All right.
A yes or no.
Ambassador Gary Duer, Canada's ambassador to the United States. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, John.
We move now to Iran, and a widely anticipated deadline on the question of Iran's nuclear program has come and gone. Hopes for a deal between the U.S. and Western leaders and Iran's leadership are not expected to be helped by a reported 7-month delay. Any talk that a historic and fundamental break in the relationship between Iran and the West is nearby, that talk is all fading. President Obama has even said the two sides are still far apart. Thomas Erdbrink, Tehran bureau chief for our partner, The New York Times, joins us. Welcome back to The Takeaway, Tom.
Thanks for having me.
So, Thomas, have the negotiators dodged a deadline here, dodged a bullet, kicked the can down the road? How do you characterize this?
I'd say kick the can down the road. I mean, one thing is clear after 1 year of talking is that these two parties, Iran and the world powers, just haven't gotten that far just yet. And I think a lot of people will start doubting whether they can come to an agreement 6 months down the line. Now, that said, of course, a lot of things can happen in the coming 6 months. We can see, for instance, a third intifada in Israel, which will definitely harden Iran's positions. We could see a further rise of the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq, which might cause a reach out by the Americans to the Iranians. So there are a lot of uncertainties in the upcoming months. But one thing is clear, in the past year, in these 12 months, in these several rounds of talks, they haven't really gotten that far.
And yet these uncertainties that you describe, many of them would, at least in theory, push the parties closer together. Can you describe what's sort of coming out of the fog here a little bit?
Well, it's all really fresh, and it's very hard to me to judge here from Tehran what actually happened in Vienna and what was discussed over there. But I think one thing is very important, that there are groups in Iran and the United States who strongly oppose to any sort of agreement. Of course, in the United States, this might be the Republican Party. Some people in Congress have spoken out against certain parts of a possible deal. But in Iran, this is no different. There is a group of very determined hardliners who have been staging demonstrations and who will definitely be very, very pleased with this outcome today. They have been warning for what they call would be a bad deal, a deal in which they say Iran would surrender all their legitimate rights as a sovereign country. And they fear that President Rouhani and his negotiating team, led by Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif, is actually selling out the country. Now, we can expect, unless there is a huge change either in the region or in Iran or in the United States, that these voices will grow in strength and it will be actually even harder to cut a deal.
So your view is that time is on the side of the hardliners in both the United States and in Iran.
Absolutely. I mean, there's elections coming up in the United States, and we'll probably witness a Republican victory over there. The same thing goes here. President Rouhani is now just over a year into his presidency. The fact that there has been no nuclear agreement within a year, even despite the many, many promises by President Rouhani that there would be such a deal, it weakens his position. And the Iranians naturally will be very afraid to sign a deal with President Obama, only to see a new president, maybe a Republican president, coming into office and canceling the deal. So as this process takes longer and longer, it is much more complicated to make a sort of Nixon in China moment, which is a sort of a reset of this poisonous relationship that Iran and America have sort of not been having. So, a legacy deal, I'm not seeing it now. But again, I need to stress that I have not been in Vienna. I don't know what exactly has been discussed. And I'm only viewing this from a distance here in Tehran.
But it looks dubious to see an Obama in Tehran moment anytime between now and the end of his term, at least on the basis of what we're witnessing in Vienna. Thomas Erdbrink, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thomas Erdbrink is Tehran bureau chief for our partner, The New York Times. If you were promised endless celebrity in a place in history, how might it affect your personality? Or as a therapist, how might such notoriety affect your diagnosis of a seemingly incredible case of mental illness? This is the odd and mysterious context of one of the most famous cases in the history of psychiatry. This week, our friends at Retro Report look back at the case of Shirley Mason, a psychiatric patient whose story told under another name became the 1976 movie Sybil. And for a generation, the name Sybil was synonymous with bizarre split personalities.
Who does those drawings?
You do.
Well, but you do them as other people. Do you understand?
At Sally Field as Sybil and Joanne Woodward as the psychiatrist, Dr. Cornelia Wilbur, who treated the real Shirley Mason. What made this case different is that rather than simply add to the scientific literature, Dr. Wilbur encouraged novelist Flora Schreiber to write the 1973 best-selling book, Sybil.
Just one of the most fascinating cases, I guess, that's ever happened in psychiatric history. Has anybody suggested this is a hoax?
Tragically, it isn't a hoax. It would be much better for Sybil and possibly for all of us if it were, because this was dreadful to bear.
It's Dr. Wilbur and Professor Schreiber on The Dick Cavett Show, part of their notoriety and celebrity. And looking back at all of that is Barbara Dury, contributing producer for Retro Report. Welcome.
Thank you.
So this is a case of where clinical truth and fiction kind of got mixed up a little bit?
I think so. What happened was Dr. Cornelia Wilbur had seen Shirley Mason in the 40s, actually, in Omaha. She had had a lot of trouble. She was fainting, and she had actually – her parents were the ones who took her to Dr. Wilbur, who had a practice in Omaha. She saw her for several sessions, and she gave her some advice, and she was feeling better. And then Dr. Wilbur moved on. She actually moved to New York. And they came together again 9 years later when she was in Sybil, who is Shirley Mason, who became Sybil, when she was at Columbia doing some graduate work. And she found out how they got together, I'm not sure, but she found out that Dr. Wilbur was practicing on Park Avenue. And she started seeing her. And things moved very quickly from that point. It was within the first few sessions or within a few months that she started exhibiting personalities.
And the real question here is, what of this is clinical and what of this is a temptation on the part of Dr. Wilbur to expand something into a realm that was more fictional than actually clinical? Here's a Retro Report speaking to Debbie Nathan, author of Sybil Exposed, the extraordinary story behind the famous multiple personality case.
Dr. Wilbur was looking for trauma. She had this idea that something terrible had made Shirley split. She didn't really know what it was, so Shirley would be questioned pretty ruthlessly about things that her mother might have done to her, with a lot of specific suggestions by Dr. Wilbur.
So the suggestions came from Wilbur, and Sybil might have been acting out, or Mason might have been acting out?
Well, there are a lot of leading questions from Dr. Wilbur, and you can see all of this in Flora Schreiber's papers, which are at John Jay College. She taught there, and she left her papers there. And a lot of the transcripts from the therapy sessions are there. And she is very suggestive and zeroes in very quickly on her mother, that her mother had done these terrible things to her.
Very Freudian, very consistent with our sort of attitudes at the time about psychiatry. But isn't it odd that it is a novelist that has the archive question and answer interrogations and interviews from these clinical sessions? Was this chemically induced?
Heavy drugs were used. And in fact, Shirley Mason became addicted at one point. But she would use sodium pentothal, which of course now we know can produce a lot of fantasies and even lying. So it was chemically induced.
Looking back from today, what do we learn from that case? What's the lesson from that case?
I think it's important to understand that it can be dangerous for people. Shirley Mason clearly had mental illness. She had some problems. What it stemmed from is unclear. And I think a lot of patients who went through this frenzy, if you will, at the time period had mental illness and they had problems that they needed to deal with. And perhaps they went down the wrong road and it took them longer to get the help they really needed.
Barbara Durie is contributing producer for Retro Report. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Never had trouble dealing with nothing. Now all of a sudden he's like falling apart. He cries for no reason. He can't sleep.
Sometimes I forget how seriously you guys take Thanksgiving.
Everything's cold. The turkey's dried out and the stuffing's all soggy.
He can't breathe. It's like gets dizzy.
You smell something, Rabbit?
Fear.
This guy just wants to know what he can do to make it stop.
Yes, make it stop. Those Thanksgiving flashback memories. Call it kitchen PTSD, pre-turkey stress and dementia. Well, The Takeaway's got your back. Our friend Dan Pashman can analyze this. He knows about hosting. The voice of WNYC's Sporkful podcast and the author of Eat More Better, How to Make Every Bite More Delicious, says pre-Thanksgiving host stress comes in at least two varieties.
There are two kinds of hosts.
Right.
Missionaries and martyrs. Missionary host is a host who leads by example, who really participates in the merriment as well as providing it.
Having a good time.
That's right. The martyr is the host who never really quite manages to sit down at the table, who really gives up their own merriment to tend to others.
Sweats a lot.
Right, but gets joy from knowing that he or she has made others happy. Me personally—
Joy that may not be apparent to anyone else in the room.
Exactly, right. Like I strive to be a missionary, but sometimes, you know, I creep into martyrdom. I don't know about you, John. Where do you stand on that spectrum?
I would say the energy output is martyrdom, but I'm having a great time and everybody seems to enjoy it. And I will regularly cook Thanksgiving for like 20, 25, 30. And I sometimes find more the merrier. For me, the martyr point comes at that time when I'm really worried about everything being done at the same moment. That's the place that's dicey for me, that I get really kind of terrified and probably look more like a martyr.
Yeah. But I think also, John, I think if I have a message here today for you and for our loyal listeners, it's let yourself off the hook a little bit. You know, I mean, in one of my Thanksgiving episodes of The Sporkful, I went to Brooke Gladstone's house, Brooke of On the Media here at WNYC.
Right, yep.
And we went to – she was going to show me how to cook her trademark Thanksgiving dessert. And everything that could possibly go wrong went wrong. And
– because Brooke is a martyr.
No, because Brooke is an absent-minded professor. She's a genius but a little flighty in the kitchen.
There you go.
And but we had a great time. And the food was still delicious. And so the point is, like, you know, it doesn't have to be that Norman Rockwell painting.
You know, and a lot of these Thanksgiving dishes are just mushed up and they taste great no matter how they look. I mean, the turkey's got to look good, but everything else, you know, you just kind of scoop it and that plate looks pretty sort of full and ugly in the end. And taste is all that really matters on Thanksgiving.
Taste matters, but I think there's also a couple of really simple things that a good host can do to create the illusion of
elegance.
Right. Number one on the list, cloth napkins.
Nice.
You know, like I always say, I feel like when you get a car, there's all these different features you can get or not get. To me, the most important is leather seats. Because when you sit down in a leather seat in a car, like you could be driving a Pinto and you feel like a million bucks. And cloth napkins at the Thanksgiving table are your leather interior.
And they have the benefit that they haven't killed any animals to make the cloth napkins, which, of course, is nice for all our animal lover listeners.
I suppose. What, why, but are paper napkins made out of animals?
No, no, but leather seats are made out of animals,
oh.
Dan, for heaven's sakes. All right, let's get some questions here. Linda, one of our listeners, what about the guest who's the perennial provocateur, usually a relative, or how to ward off the expected annual family conflict?
There's a couple things I can recommend. The first is moderate consumption of alcohol. And I talk in my book, I have a chart about buzz management, which at long haul events, which I think is a crucial point. I think that moderate alcohol consumption is a good thing. Mo Rocca has advice on dealing with family in an episode of The Sporkful. Here's what he told me.
Life is not a movie of the week. And there's not going to be some great resolution or coming to terms, probably. There's not. And the best you can do is manage situations. And you should feel proud about that. I mean, I think bad movies have taught us, have deceived us into believing that there's such a thing as kind of resolution or coming full circle or something like that. And I think Thanksgiving, that doesn't happen. And people should feel proud for surviving Thanksgiving and managing situations and getting along, you know, and feel good about having held their tongue or, you know, I'm sorry, this is sounding so serious, but I mean it.
Yeah, no, this is good advice, actually.
I think people, you should feel like that's an accomplishment. You shouldn't feel like a loser.
Are you crying, John?
Well, no. I just worry a little bit more about August Osage County in my house for Thanksgiving. That's definitely the problem.
Well, that's why I said moderate alcohol consumption.
But how do you do that? I mean, do you water down the stuff at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and then maybe it's stronger by 4, and then at 6, it's the hard stuff.
Well, what you want to do is you want to think very carefully. This is another very important point of hosting.
Right.
Think carefully about the schedule,
right,
and the invitation that you send out and the information you're transmitting to people. For instance, if you think you're going to sit down for Thanksgiving dinner at 4 p.m.,
right,
don't invite people for noon because now they have 4 hours there, yeah, to get drunk and start fighting.
Mm-hmm.
Invite them for 3. Then they have time to have a drink or two, and then they're going to start eating. And once that food gets into their stomach, it slows alcohol absorption into the bloodstream. And now we have some effective buzz management taking place.
Buzz management. How about guests who arrive with their pets? This is another question from Linda.
Yeah, I mean, I think that if you're a guest, you should always ask in advance before you bring a pet. I don't think you should just show up, especially if it's a large pet or a shedding pet. I'm allergic to animals that shed, so I'd be a little bit irritated if you showed up with some kind of giant, as much as I love animals, giant hairball, furball. So you should ask in advance before you do that.
Now, you know, I don't care how much buzz management you do. By the end of the meal, you've got some questionably competent people here, right? How do you keep them from cleaning up? This is what Karen asked.
Oh, I see.
How do I keep drunk guests from helping with cleanup? You're talking about the elegance, right, with the
right
cloth napkins, but you got your nice glassware out on the table. My sisters-in-law have broken more wine goblets with their hams for hands, Karen, thanks for sharing, than I even care to count. They know I love them.
I think that you got a couple options if you really want to prevent them from cleaning up. One is to have them drink so much that they're asleep on the couch, but that has other pitfalls. Another is to give them a different task that doesn't involve dealing with breakables. Have them sweep up the floor. Put the cloth napkins in the washing machine and shake out the tablecloth outside.
All right. So what about the kids' table? What's your view on the kids' table? Kids' table is a good thing to have, but not a kids' table with SpaghettiOs.
That's right. I mean, look, the reason why the kids' table was invented is that the grown-ups could enjoy themselves.
Exactly.
Right. And so if the kids' table is created in such a way that it's going to require a constant maintenance and tending, then what's the point? So you want activities at the kids' table.
Right.
I recommend that you get those long sheets of paper or paper on rolls and cover the whole table with paper and give out crayons and markers.
Oh, you've been to Applebee's a few times, I guess.
Yeah.
Huh?
Yeah. You know, hey, if it works, John,
yeah.
If it works.
Host away out there in takeaway land. Some advice from our good friend Dan Pashman, who is the host of the WNYC Sporkful podcast, author of the book Eat More Better, How to Make Every Bite More Delicious. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you, John.
and the reassuring Dan Pashman will be with us all week long. And there'll be a hour-long special called A Very Sporkful Thanksgiving that you can check out. Call us with your Thanksgiving stories, good or bad, at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. And if you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the show, check us out anytime at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.